Hello, this is Mikey, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 14th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And we'll start with the first article. Hostages and prisoners freed with Gaza's path unclear. Many of them had become household names, their faces familiar from posters all over the country. Israelis snatched 2 years ago from their homes in pastoral border villages, from a music festival rave, and from army bases, and then secreted into Hamas's tunnels deep under Gaza. When they finally emerged on Monday as part of a ceasefire deal reached between Israel and Hamas, they were thinner, wan, but alive and on their feet. And Israelis basked in a joyous moment of unifying national redemption after months of agonizing, polarizing war. The 20 living hostages who had remained in Gaza, along with the remains of 28 deceased ones, remained an open wound, with the fate of the hostages tearing at the country's soul. A majority of Israelis had long wanted Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to prioritize their release with the deal to end the war, polls showed. But Mr. Netanyahu accused protesters of, quote, hardening Hamas's stance, unquote, while critics of the prime minister accused him in turn of prolonging the war to appease his far-right political allies, on whose support he relies to stay in power. Now, many Israelis said, with an open-ended ceasefire in place and all the living hostages back home, it was time for the country to heal. This is a momentous day, a day of great joy, Mr. Netanyahu said in an address to the Knesset, or Israeli parliament, on Monday alongside President Trump. Quoting from the biblical book of Ecclesiastes, which Jews traditionally read this week, Mr. Netanyahu said, "There was a time for war and a time for peace. The last 2 years have been a time of war," he added. "The coming years will hopefully be a time for peace, peace inside Israel and peace outside Israel." People began packing Hostages Square in Tel Aviv early Monday morning to watch the release unfold on giant screens. They lined the road waving Israeli flags outside the Re'im military base in southern Israel, the first stop for the returnees after they crossed into Israeli territory. And they ran onto balconies and rooftops to cheer as helicopters brought the former captives to hospitals. The military released footage of emotional reunions between the hostages and their family members, as well as extraordinary encounters among the former captives themselves. Gali and Ziv Berman, 28, twins who were kidnapped on October 7, 2023, together with their neighbor, Emily Damari, from Kfar Aza, a rural community, were separated by their captors on their first day in Gaza, according to Ms. Damari, who was released during a brief ceasefire in January. On Monday, they hugged. The twins, who had lived close by and worked together before their abduction, were transferred to a hospital wearing matching yellow shirts of their favorite soccer team, Maccabi Tel Aviv. They were flown over the Bloomfield Stadium in Tel Aviv, where fans had gathered to cheer them. And there's a picture of them in a helicopter. Another pair of brothers, Ariel Cuneo, 28, and David Cuneo, 35, were released and united with their partners in Israel, both former captives themselves. Ariel Cuneo had been kidnapped with his partner, Arbel Yehud, from their home in Nir Oz, a small community near the Gaza border that was ravaged in the Hamas assault. Ms. Yehud was released in January. My Ariel is home, and I am overwhelmed with emotion and joy, Ms. Yehud said in a statement. From the moment of my release, I devoted everything I had to the struggle to bring my Ariel home, to bring David home, and to bring all the hostages back, she added. Now that Ariel and David are home, we can focus on our long journey of healing and recovery together as a couple and as a family. David Cuneo was kidnapped from Nir Oz with his wife Sharon Cuneo and their twin daughters, Yuli and Emma, 5, who were returned in November 2023. And the brothers Eitan Horn and Ar, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, I-A-R, Horn let out cries of joy as they embraced. Taken from Nir Oz, they spent time in the tunnels together until Yar was released in February with Eitan left behind. The 20 living hostages released on Monday were exchanged for nearly 2,000 Palestinians imprisoned in Israel. There are no more living captives in Gaza, but Israel was still waiting for Hamas to return the remains of 28 deceased ones. The Israeli military said it had received 4 coffins later Monday and that the authorities would work to identify the remains. The government had said that locating some of the bodies might take some time. We do not forget them for a moment, Brigadier General Effie Defrin, the Israeli military chief spokesman, said. Israeli officials said about 1,200 people were killed in Israel and 251 others were abducted to Gaza during the Hamas-led attack on Israel in October 2023 that ignited the war. Hamas had already been holding 2 Israeli civilians for almost a decade and the remains of 2 soldiers killed in ambushes in Gaza in 2014. 4 women were released early on in October 23, and a female soldier was rescued in a military operation that month. During 2 temporary ceasefires in November 2023 and early this year, a total of 135 hostages were freed, according to government data. The Trump administration negotiated the release of an Israeli American soldier in May. 7 more hostages were rescued alive by the Israeli military. The remains of 59 captives who did not survive were returned to Israel for burial before Monday's exchange, according to the Israeli government. More than 67,000 Palestinians have been killed during Israel's 2-year counter-offensive in Gaza, according to local health officials, whose data does not distinguish between civilians and combatants and includes thousands of children. The drill on Monday was similar in some ways to past releases. The living hostages were handed over to Red Cross representatives in Gaza, who transferred them to Israeli forces near the border. From there, they were taken in military convoys to the Re'im Army base in southern Israel for initial checks and reunions with close family members, and were then flown to hospitals in the Tel Aviv area. But this time was also different. For the first time in years, there were no living hostages left in Gaza, allowing for a large degree of closure. Moreover, Mr. Trump, who brokered the deal, has made it clear it signals not another temporary pause, but the end of the war. The hostages returned smiling and, at least on the surface, in better condition than many Israelis had feared. Hamas had released gruesome photos of some of the captives looking skeletal and pleading for their lives. Former hostages have described how some were abused and kept in chains, but this time there were no humiliating handover ceremonies in Gaza like this during some past releases, when masked gunmen instructed those being released, sometimes weak and emaciated, to wave at crowds from a stage and make speeches thanking captors. Instead, Israelis glued to their televisions on Monday were surprised to see some hostages still in Hamas custody speaking to their parents via video calls from Gaza, while masked gunmen could be seen in the background. Inav Zengauker, the mother of Matan Zengauker, 25, and one of the most vocal activists of the struggle for hostages' release, was filmed speaking on a video call with her son in Gaza for the first time since his abduction 2 years ago. "There's no war, it's over," she told him. "Sitting in a car on the way to the Re'im Army Base, you are coming home." Wow. Let's see. Okay. Now we'll try to get, this website's a little different for me, I apologize. "A divided Israel unites in joy as hostages come home. With the release from Gaza of the last surviving captives, many Israelis said it was time for the country to heal after years of polarizing war. Many of them had become household names, their faces familiar." I wonder if I'm reading the first one all over again. I am. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry that I'm spazzing so much on this. Okay, here we go. Well, let's read now why Ukraine is betting on strikes deep inside Russia. This is on page 5, and we'll see if we can get it. Sorry that I'm bringing you along on my journey. Okay. "The Kremlin will negotiate only if missiles and drones bring the pain of war home to Russia," Ukrainian officials say. And there's a picture, a satellite image, overview of destroyed ammunition depots at Engels Airfield in Russia's Saratov region in March after a Ukrainian drone attack. "Movement on the front lines in Ukraine has largely stalled in a bloody stalemate. The Trump administration's peace talks haven't budged since Russia turned down a ceasefire in August, but Ukrainian officials argue that they still have a strategy to end the war, strike deep inside Russia with missiles and drones. Refineries, factories, ports, and railroad lines have already been blown up. Ukraine now has an arsenal capable of hitting much of Western Russia, where much of the country's oil processing industry is concentrated. Kiev has also announced a new weapon called the Flamingo that it says could reach Russia's industrial heartland in the Ural Mountains. With long-range strikes, Ukraine aims to batter the country's oil industry and bring the pain of the war home to Russians. The question is whether the strategy will be enough to sway the Kremlin to negotiate in earnest." What is Ukraine thinking? "The ramping up of the deep strike campaign is Ukraine's latest reinvention of its war effort. Ukraine pushed back Russia's initial invasion with the patriotic fervor of volunteer soldiers. Later, President Volodymyr Zelensky lobbied relentlessly for Western heavy weapons to hold the trench lines. Now, long-range strikes aim to force Russia into a settlement by inflicting damage on its already strained economy and by spurring a largely pacified Russia public into beginning to agitate against the war. Mr. Zelensky calls the campaign, quote, long-range sanctions or drone sanctions, unquote, casting it as a ratcheting up of economic pressure. Putin has been offered many times to end the war or at least cease fire, Mr. Zelensky said in a video address to Ukrainians on Wednesday, referring to President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia. He spurned all proposals, ours and America's, so it's only fair that Russia bears the war's full cost. What weapons are being used? The drones and missiles have colorful names like Neptune, Flamingo, Furious, and Beaver. Some emerged from a robust Soviet legacy arms industry in Ukraine. Others sprang from wartime startups. Before Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022, Ukraine had a scrappy tech culture. Notable successes included Ring, the video doorbell company bought by Amazon. When Russia invaded, engineers shifted to making drones. This summer, a Ukrainian company unveiled the Flamingo, a cruise missile with a range of more than 1,800 miles. The Neptune is an anti-ship missile adapted to hit land targets. Mr. Zelensky said in recent days that both had now been used to strike inside Russia. Drones such as the Furious and the Beaver are cobbled together from plastic, carbon fiber, styrofoam, and cardboard. Though relatively small, they can fly about 600 miles, far enough to hit Moscow if they can breach Russian air defenses. Ukraine has promoted its increasing reliance on domestically produced arms to strike Russia, but it is also in talks with the United States to obtain Tomahawk missiles, which could add another long-range weapon to the campaign. Mr. Putin has warned that giving Tomahawks to Kiev would be, quote, a qualitatively new stage of escalation by the United States in the war. On Sunday, Mr. Trump hinted that he might try to use the possibility of sending the missiles to Ukraine to pressure Mr. Putin into settling the war. Mr. Zelensky will meet with Mr. Trump on Friday. What is being hit? In typically nightly exchanges of fire, the Russian military launches far more drones and missiles into Ukraine than the Ukrainian army military aims at Russia. But Ukrainian officials say that if their strikes can cause enough damage and mayhem, they could ultimately negotiate a trade. Kiev halts attacks if Moscow does the same. Over the course of the war, Ukraine has conducted many long-range strikes on Russian military sites, like ammunition depots and logistics hubs. Ukraine's current focus is on oil refineries, which are particularly prized targets that put pressure on both the economy and on morale. And let me just remind you, you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Several regions have faced fuel shortages, prompting many Russians to wait in lines to gas up their cars. And when refineries are attacked, their flammable fluids burn dramatically in ways that can be seen from miles around. While Kiev says that it does not target Russian civilians in strike, some Ukrainian leaders have spoken of the need to hit war-related sites in Moscow itself to change the Kremlin's thinking. What is Trump's response? Ukraine has said that it wants to signal the United States in every way possible, that it is compliant with President Trump's demands in settlements talks, including by giving American companies priority in potential post-war mining deals. Kiev has framed the strikes on Russia as aiding Mr. Trump's peace initiative aiming to show that Ukraine has enough firepower to make Moscow think twice about continuing to fight. Mr. Trump has said that he supports the strikes. In August, he wrote on social media that, quote, it is very hard, if not impossible, to win a war without attacking an invader's country, unquote. He went on to criticize the Biden administration for curtailing Ukraine's ability to hit inside Russia. Mr. Trump has previously faulted that administration for ultimately letting Ukraine use American long-range missiles to strike Russia. Okay. Now let's see if we can get back. Let's see what the Palestinians have to say, huh? Palestinians see little to celebrate, even though the bombs have stopped. The ceasefire in Gaza has taken hold. Hostages and prisoners have been exchanged. But amid the utter devastation of 2 years of war, a sense of gloom pervades. And I wish you could see the pictures. They're very clear, and there's nothing that looks whole. There's one long building that looks like it might go out to the sea, but otherwise there's just people and tents and rubble as far as you can see, and it's a big picture. Palestinians in Gaza expressed relief on Monday that Israel had halted its 2-year military offensive in the territory and that hostages and prisoners had been exchanged. Still, many felt there was little to celebrate. 2 years of war left the enclave in ruins, its cities reduced to rubble, tens of thousands dead, and the healthcare system devastated. Despair and hopelessness are pervasive, and many no longer see a future. It's important that the bombing has stopped, but there's nothing to be happy about, said Sayed Abu Aita, 44. Who was displaced in central Gaza. Quote, my 2 daughters were killed, my home was destroyed, and my health has deteriorated, unquote. Israel's military campaign against Hamas killed more than 67,000 people in Gaza, according to local health officials. Their tolls do not specify the number of combatants, but they say thousands were children. Some in Gaza said they do not see the release on Monday of nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners, one of Hamas's stated reasons for launching the war in the first place, as an achievement worth the cost. Hamas secured the exchange by trading the remaining hostages out of some 250 seized during the October 7th, 2023 attack on southern Israel that ignited the war. Mr. Abu Aita said that the fragment of shrapnel penetrated his rib cage when an Israeli airstrike hit his hometown, Jabalia, in northern Gaza in October 2023. Soon after the war began. For more than a year, he said, he has not been able to find a doctor who could remove the fragment. He said he hoped that the return of the last 20 living hostages to Israel on Monday, a crucial element in the ceasefire that went into effect last week, would pave the way to an end to the war. They needed to go home a long time ago, he said. Holding them in Gaza gave Israel a pretext to continue its bombing. Palestinians in Gaza have lived through hunger, fear, and bombardment. With a ceasefire now in effect, aid groups say they are attempting to scale up relief as much as possible to blunt the humanitarian catastrophe and allow people to rebuild their shattered lives. Many relief officials blamed Israeli restrictions for shortages that led to hunger and malnutrition throughout the enclave, while Israel blocked all supplies entering Gaza for nearly 3 months earlier in 2025, Israeli officials have recently said they were no longer limiting the amount of aid that can go into the territory. Under the ceasefire agreement, Israel committed to allowing a surge of desperately needed supplies into the enclave. On Sunday, the United Nations said it was working to boost its aid to Gaza, including by bringing in cooking gas for the first time since March. Many in Gaza have had to resort to making bread with firewood because there was little gas or electricity available. "For 2 years, we've dreamed of this moment," said Amani Nasir, 30. "We've had enough of tents, fire, displacement, and thirst." Under the deal, at least 600 trucks of supplies will enter Gaza per day, and Gaza's Rafah border crossing with Egypt will be reopened. Abdel Nasser al-Jamrari, the head of Gaza's Bakers Union, which works with the World Food Program to distribute subsidized bread, said the humanitarian situation in Gaza has been steadily improving since the announcement of the ceasefire last week. "Today is better than yesterday, and tomorrow will hopefully be better," he said, adding that 17 bakeries were now operating across central and southern Gaza. But there is some skepticism that the ceasefire will hold. The deal cinched last week by U.S., Qatari, Turkish, and Egyptian mediators did not resolve some of the toughest sticking points between the warring sides and left Hamas still armed and the dominant force in parts of Gaza for the time being. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel has said his government will not agree to end the war until Hamas's government and military wing in Gaza are dismantled. While Hamas has expressed willingness to hand civilian rule over to Gaza to another Palestinian entity, it has not committed to giving up its weapons. Since Israel halted its military offensive and pulled back from parts of Gaza in the past few days, Hamas has begun asserting itself on the streets of the territory. Witnesses in Gaza said they had begun to see small groups of Hamas international security fighters standing guard at some intersections. Wow. On Sunday night, Hamas fighters clashed in Gaza City with a rival gang of gunmen and attempted to capture its members, according to the Hamas-run Interior Ministry. During the visit to Israel on Monday to coincide with the hostage release, President Trump was asked by a reporter what he thought about the possibility of Hamas reasserting itself as a police force and shooting rivals. He replied that this was because, quote, "they do not want to stop the problems," unquote, and suggested the United States was not opposed temporarily. Quote, "they've been open about it and we gave them approval for a period of time," unquote, Mr. Trump said. Mr. Trump's ambitious vision for Gaza includes bringing in a post-war security force to stabilize the enclave, as well as training a new Palestinian police force to maintain law and order. But that prospect will be difficult should Hamas insist on continuing to play a dominant role in the enclave. Abdullah Shahab, 32, said he was worried that the respite in fighting would only be temporary because Hamas has not agreed to Israel's condition for ending the war. In recent days, Mr. Shahab said Hamas was trying to show that it, quote, hasn't given up its rule in Gaza, unquote. On Sunday, he said masked gunmen who he believed were members of Hamas stopped him on the way to the dentist and inspected his car. "The situation is very fragile," he said. "The weak party, Hamas, hasn't been convinced to accept the strong party's demands." Okay, let's go back and see what else we have. I'm going to just check and see. Okay. Now let's see what's going on in Tennessee, huh? Tennessee sheriff becomes the face of grief after plant explosion. The blast that killed 16 people has left area residents reeling, including Sheriff Chris Davis of Humphreys County, who has fought back tears in his public briefings. I am just going to remind you, you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Chris Davis, the sheriff of Humphreys County, Tennessee, has barely sat down at the log cabin restaurant in the community of Hurricane Mills when he was back on his feet to receive a hug. "They got the right man for the job," a worker at the restaurant said after embracing him. "The whole county knows it." "You're going to put tears in my eyes," Sheriff Davis said. He grabbed a napkin a few minutes later. It was the start of another emotional day for Mr. Davis, who has become the face of local grief in public briefings after a blast at an explosives plant on his county line left 16 people dead. He has publicly stood alongside another sheriff, Jason Kraft of neighboring Hickman County, as well as agents and experts sifting through the volatile remains of the explosion. But Sheriff Davis has drawn notice for fighting through his anguish to relay the magnitude of the devastation, frequently pausing in an effort to compose himself. Across several small rural communities of Middle Tennessee region, everyone is seemingly connected in some way to the families of the victims who have yet to be formally identified. And Sheriff Davis is no different. He too knows some of the families personally. He was out front again on Sunday, standing with Governor Bill Lee and visiting with the families at a church near the Accurate Energetic Systems facility where the explosion occurred. Governor Lee, who took an aerial tour of the site, pledged a thorough investigation into the explosion and offered his condolences and prayers to the families. "It is rare to see a law enforcement official or politician be so unabashedly emotional in public, even in the aftermath of tragedy. Mr. Davis is not as guarded or polished on camera as some of his counterparts elsewhere in the country, but he has been cautious about saying anything that could hurt an already grieving family or speaking without certainty during a fluctuating situation, a sincerity that has endeared him to his fellow residents. Maybe that's not customary or usual, but that's just who he is," said Jesse Wallace, who, as a former Humphreys County executive, once worked with Sheriff Davis. Quote, "He's got a heart as big as he is, and he's a big guy." Humphreys County has always been home for Sheriff Davis, who was born and raised in the county seat of Waverly, Tennessee, about 70 miles west of Nashville. He was always set on joining law enforcement and first became a dispatcher as a 17-year-old. He received the nickname Heavy D, which followed him to this day. He was first elected to be sheriff in 2006. He has at times run unopposed. Before the Friday explosion, he was focused on the process of building a new jail. He was also coordinating a catfish fry fundraiser, one of his specialties, for Angel Tree, a program that provides Christmas gifts to children and older residents. And in recent weeks, his office had to help figure out which farmer had a black bull who got loose. "He's a man of God. He pours it out," said Stephen Whittorp, 70, who stood at an emotional vigil where Sheriff Davis worshiped with his community Sunday evening. "We need him." Early Friday, Sheriff Davis got a call from dispatch that there had been an explosion, a big one. His lieutenant called from the facility gate, quote, "Sheriff, I need you here. This is magnified," he recalled. A few minutes later, he got another call, quote, "I need you now," unquote. When he arrived, Sheriff Davis said he thought, "My God, I've walked into hell," unquote. He has seen disaster before, including a separate incident at the same facility involving a different company. The disaster that has stayed with him is the 2021 flash flooding that ravaged Waverly, killing 20 people and decimating homes and businesses. Since the flood, he said, quote, "I'm more outwardly emotional." Quote, "The flood changed my person. It changed my inner person," he added. "I still deal with a lot. I still cope with a lot." He nodded to his bracelet, featuring a cross and the Lord's Prayer on it. During an early briefing, he said he found himself looking at the families who were waiting for word of lost loved ones and neighbors, including someone he had known since he was a child. Quote, "It starts hitting me who these folks really are to me. It's hard for me to hold that emotion," he said. He added that it could very easily be me sitting in that spot, and I try to be thoughtful and mindful of what their needs and their feelings are. Sheriff Davis does not often speak about his own work without pointing to those who helped him. They include Sheriff Kraft, the people who dropped off crucial tools and supplies during the 2021 floods, the sheriffs with whom he once served on the same patrol shift together and who still talk via group text. On Sunday, they offered help. You don't want to put him in that position because he's been in so much over the years, but also he has experience, said Mr. Kraft, who first ran for sheriff in 2022 when his mother got into a fatal car accident about 5 years ago. Mr. Davis was there, holding her hand as she died. The two sheriffs were friendly before and have been close since. On Sunday morning, Sheriff Davis's meal, French dip sandwich, well-done fries, and an appropriately sweet iced Arnold Palmer was on the house, a waitress told him with a hug, though he still tossed money on the table. As the sheriff moved toward the exit, he was stopped again and again for a hug and a tearful word of thanks. But he could not stay. There was another briefing to get to. Wow. It's quite an article. It even has me up teary. Sue Goldie has Parkinson's disease. An acclaimed researcher is an expert at explaining complicated problems. Now she has to confront the most vexing question. What is happening to her? Dr. Sue Goldie is an award-winning Harvard professor, a physician, and a public health scientist. She is an expert at artfully explaining complicated global problems like pandemics. When she noticed something that put everything at risk, her health, her career, her identity, she kept it a secret as long as she could. And there's a picture here. I'm reading on a computer, and it's a hand shaking, something we've all seen on anybody with Parkinson's, and it's obviously Dr. Goldie's. Now she has to explain the most complicated question of all. What is happening to her? It starts with a tingle, a tremor, a sense that something is off. Dr. Sue Goldie didn't doesn't recognize the symptoms at first. Maybe she ignores them, wishes them away. It's 2021. She's 59, in the prime of a long teaching career at Harvard. She has just immersed herself in the sport of triathlon. One coach notes something off with her running cadence. Another wonders why her left arm isn't fully lifting out of the water. A trainer sees a slight tremor. The first time Sue races, she feels a strange vibration, like an internal tremble. Then Sue sees it herself, twitching fingers on her left hand. Tests reveal it's Parkinson's, the incurable neurological disease that robs its victims of their motor skills and sometimes their minds, one extinguished neuron at a time. Parkinson's doesn't always alter lifespan, but it always upends lives. The diagnosis elicits a storm of emotions, but also raises questions, both pragmatic and deep, that have consumed Sue since. At what point, if ever, do I have to say something? Who needs to know? What do I reveal and what do I conceal? And most profoundly, does a diagnosis have to be an identity? For nearly 4 years, she keeps her diagnosis from most Harvard administrators, colleagues, and students, worried about what it will do to her reputation. She grows more comfortable revealing herself away from work in the world of triathlon. I feel very strongly that I should be able to disclose this when I want, how I want, and it's under my control, she tells me last year. But Parkinson's does not wait. Maybe others don't notice the physical signs, not yet. They don't see her in the early morning, shuffling off balance to the bathroom before her medications kick in. A daily reminder that Parkinson's was not something she dreamed last night. Maybe they don't see the pill boxes in her purse, the exposed feeling she gets when the dopamine medication wears off, the persistent worry behind her cheerful disposition. They certainly don't know how hard everything has become. They don't know how terrified she is. Her symptoms are worsening. Disguising them is exhausting. Starting today, she is Sue with Parkinson's. Most people she knows will learn of her diagnosis by reading this story. And there's a picture of Dr. Sue writing something on the wall on a chalkboard. She has glasses on and long shoulder-length brown hair, and she looks great. Even some of those closest to her will discover that she has been secretly chronicling her fight through the thousands of video diaries. She began recording them when her symptoms made writing by hand too tedious. The videos are time capsules of joy and grief, of wonder and despair. They are a chronological library of her symptoms, a place where she sorts her feelings. The transcriptions fill 3-ring binders on her bookshelves. She records the videos on her phone, in her Subaru, in her office, on the go. Some are optimistic and self-deprecating. Some are searingly emotional, like when she opens up about her struggles, her worries, her fear over whether she can even go on. "Hello, Sue," she will say, or "Hello to myself," and she will explain how she is feeling. Sue and I meet in 2023. She and I agreed from the outset that this story would not be published until she was ready for her diagnosis to be revealed. For more than 2 years, she confides her darkest thoughts and her evolving hopes in person and during hours-long video calls, but mostly through hundreds of videos sent by text message. I see and learn things that she tells no one else. "I'm strong," she says to me, "really strong, and vulnerable too, both can be true. And there's a picture of her, I think, swimming with her head down. She looks sad. She knows what's coming. There's no reversing the course. She can picture the images of Michael J. Fox and others who have Parkinson's, many of whom are in wheelchairs and struggle to speak. They are the windows to her future. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Most of the 1 million Americans living with Parkinson's, a growing number because of an aging population, will quietly fade away. But how many have her skills and connections? Quote, "I'll die with this disease," she tells me, "but I do have control over what I do with it in the next few years," unquote. After decades of examining the world's biggest health problems, she has to turn the lens around. She has to try to explain what Parkinson's does to a person, but not just any person, herself. Quote, "I want to get things done while I'm still the best me," she says. "It's time." And time, she knows, is running out. And there's a picture, I think, of her saying these words. And they said that she was doing some of the recordings in her car. And it looks like that's where she is. She has a coat on and she's crying. "I'm trying hard to, like, do all this stuff that will help. But I'm not feeling okay and I don't know. I'm feeling so desperate and so by myself. I don't want to. I don't know what to do. I just need to not be alone with it. I don't want to talk, but I just feel like I don't know where to turn. I'm trying hard to, like, do all this stuff that will help. But I'm not feeling okay, and I don't know. I'm feeling so desperate and so by myself. I don't want to do. I just need to not be alone with it. I don't want to talk. But I just feel like I don't know where to turn. I'm trying hard to, like, do all this stuff that will help. But I'm not feeling okay and I don't know. I'm feeling so desperate and so by myself. I don't want to. I don't know what to do. I just need to not be alone with it. I don't want to talk, but I just feel like I don't know where to turn. I'm trying hard to do all this stuff that will help, but I'm not feeling okay and I don't know. And this is the next part of the article. That was a video. Sue is an enthusiastic storyteller, and now she's telling a story from the summer of 2019. She is watching one of her two grown sons prepare for an upcoming Ironman triathlon, a 2.4-mile swim, a 112-mile bicycle ride, and a 26.2-mile run. Sue is inspired. She rushes to a store to buy a swimsuit, jumps in the lake, and swims a bit and throws up. She loves it. She announces to her family that she's going to do Ironmans too. Sue is not a swimmer, cyclist, or runner. She will become the rare triathlete, she says, who sucks at all three, unquote. It just seems so intriguing and so impossible, and I like the little outfits, she tells me. Sue finds a patient triathlon coach who will become a trusted confidant. She chooses a bike, red because she likes the color, and befriends the triathletes at the local bike shop. She starts to jog around her block in Newton, Mass. "I thought she was nuts," her husband, Aaron Waxman, says, "but I learned long ago that things will never just pass. If she says she's going to do something, get out of her way," unquote. One step, then another. It's her mantra. If you can do 10 steps, you can do 11. If you can do a million, you can do a million and one. Keep moving until something stops you. Soon, soon is working out 10, 15, 20 hours a week. She swims at a rec center before dawn, runs miles along the Charles River at sunset, pedals in her basement for hours at night. She and Aaron, an avid cyclist, go on long weekend rides. Sue attempts her first Ironman, in 2021 at Lake Placid, New York. She passes out on the bike and wakes up in an ambulance. She is smitten. She vows to return in 2022. And there's a picture now of her and her husband at home, and he's zipping her up into her wetsuit. Then comes the diagnosis. Sue freaks out. She says, but tells almost no one. She throws herself into medical research, one of the places where she is most comfortable. Two things have been shown to stem the symptoms of Parkinson's. If not slow, it's progression. Medication and exercise. I was reading paper after paper, and I'm like, quote, this is unbelievable, she said. How lucky could I be? The very sport I'm doing is probably the most effective thing for this disease, unquote. She will be her own experiment. She will try to offset her body's imminent erosion with intense exercise. I am not an N of one, she says. Through the trial and error, she and others develop workarounds for her growing symptoms. Pink tape on her hands to provide visual clues of her swim stroke, special gear shifters, and a long tube rigged as a straw on her bike's water bottle because she no longer has the dexterity and balance to take a hand off the handlebars. First year, I could. Second year, a little. Third year, not at all, she says. Transitions between triathlons, three disciplines is where Sue often loses the most time compared with other triathletes. Worsening tremors and declining balance complicate simple tasks like pulling zippers, fastening clips. She struggles to climb out of wetsuits, open nutritional gel packs, and tinker with equipment. And there's a picture of a gazillion people with their bikes and all these triathletes, and she's getting on her bike sneakers. Medications, she has to manage tiny pills and wild swings in her dopamine levels over hours of racing. Too much, she vomits. Too little, she collapses. In 2022, Sue completes the Lake Placid Ironman. Short of the finish line, out of sight, she stops, sits down, and cries. Those tracking her coordinates wonder what happened. Is Sue okay? She applies lipstick and jogs to the finish. SFG, her tiny team calls her, the middle initial standing for an unprintable adjective. How many Parkinson's patients have completed a full Ironman? That's not the story. That finish line was just the start. For major symptoms of Parkinson's are related to movement, and they often start on one side of the body. Tremors, bradykinesia, slowness, which is slowness of movement, rigidity, stiff limbs, postural instability, which is balance. They sneak up until one day they are all you notice. Non-motor problems can include depression and anxiety. Cognition can suffer. There may be an increased possibility of dementia. Sue's biggest fears for now are a loss of identity, of dignity, of worth. It's a theme of her videos, a sense that she is disappearing. She has recurring dreams about drowning. Tremors or symptoms, that pales in comparisons to knowing that I'm losing who I am, she says. Her humor skews dark, and no subject is off limits. After one long run, Sue records a video to herself about incontinence. Fun fact for a Sunday, she says cheerfully. It's a big problem with Parkinson's. No one wants to talk about it. Even your doctor doesn't really want to talk about it. Case in point, I'm talking to myself right now. Parkinson's patients slowly lose the neurons that produce dopamine, a neurotransmitter that acts like a messenger between neurons or nerve cells. The disease mostly affects a cluster of neurons that control the speed and quality of a person's movement. Medications can help raise dopamine levels. Eventually, though, the key neurons fade like stars at dawn. Even the strongest medications won't help. Sue wonders how many neurons she has left. Saving the neurons is a personal motto written on her water bottles, ID bracelets, and bike bag. I don't have the neurons for that, she will shout when her patience is tested. Scientifically, when you get diagnosed, you've probably lost 80% of your neurons, she said, but you might live another 15 years. So we're in the forgotten section. You're not bad enough to get all the attention. You're not stooped over or in a wheelchair, which is what the visuals are, but you're also not the healthy person who doesn't have it. You're in the middle. As her Parkinson's is revealed, Sue worries that others will reduce her to little more than her diagnosis. She has a deep fear of being misunderstood, underestimated, and dismissed. Telling people, even people close to me, can make it harder, Sue tells me in 2024. Even the people close to you can't fully understand. I feel this at times when a glib comment makes her fearful that I don't understand basic things about her. She has recorded videos to me, including angry ones that I have never seen and good-humored ones that I have in response to things I didn't realize upset her. She often tells me how distressing it is when someone who knows her diagnosis, a doctor, a friend, tells her how well she seems to be doing. You have no idea how hard it is to trick you into thinking I'm okay, she says. This plays out most starkly at Harvard. She knows that whispers about health or mental capacity can alter reputations, especially at esteemed universities. It's touchy, but shouldn't these issues be in the open? Sue wonders, shouldn't we talk about them? She wants to spark the discussion. She worries about the silent repercussions from people who might now see her as diminished. Last fall, before she tells her own dean and others in her administrative chain of command, Sue goes to the top, to Harvard's president, Alan Garber. He is a longtime friend and colleague. She brings a framed photo from her office of the two of them smiling after receiving awards at Harvard years ago. His response to her diagnosis is kind, but more muted than Sue hopes. She instantly regrets telling him, quote, I'm just feeling like super institutionally vulnerable, she says in a tearful video message afterwards. I'm feeling like I've told the most important person at the university, and I'm not having any exhale moment at all, unquote. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 14th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Mikey. I apologize for the spazzing out in the beginning.